Good morning. All you non-vacationers, welcome. Glad you're here. Thanks for joining us today. Raise your hand if you like a Bible. I'm doing a kind of an overview type of a sermon today, so we won't be really pounding through a specific text, but you could check out John 17. That's where we'll end. And there's also sermon notes pages. This will help you follow along. This is especially helpful today because we're filling out another cool diagram. And then please note the things on the back of the notes card. Specifically, each week we are posting a new reflection from someone in the community on the topic of suffering well. And last night I posted the second half of an interview I did with Eric Cummings, which is, thank you for that, which is worth your time. Can you grab a basket if you're seated over here and just hand it down? And if you're new with us and would like to fill out a communication card, you're welcome to do that. If you'd like to hand off contact information, just fill out a card and put it in one of the boxes by the doors, and that'll enable us to reach out to you and get connected. Or just say hi to me today, because there's not too many of us today. I'd love to meet you. Right on. Grateful if you're joining us online from wherever you are. May this be encouraging for you as well. All right, I want to start this sermon with a disclaimer. I'm feeling a little self-conscious today as I address this topic. I'm concerned that in addressing this topic, some of you may feel like he's preaching to me. He's talking to me. The reality is, by addressing this topic, I'm talking to everybody. I'm talking to all of us. Some of you may feel like I'm preaching at you. I wouldn't do that. I don't do that. I don't use this place and this time to have personal conversations. I have a lot of really pointed, challenging, sensitive, confidential, amazing conversations all week long, but those happen in offices and in homes, and this is a place where I'm careful to speak to the whole community. Sundays are for the whole community. So here's what I do. For Sundays, I'll pray, and I'll read, and I'll walk, and I'll study, and I'll wait for things to disturb me and challenge me, and we often are setting sermon topics several months in advance. And one of the beauties of that is that it keeps the preaching from being reactive, if there's ever a temptation to become reactive in preaching. So today's topic's been set for a couple months, and if it feels like I'm preaching to you today, please know I'm preaching to me today. In fact, I've already preached this sermon like 5 times to me this week. And if it feels a bit close to home today, then my encouragement to you would be pay attention and thank God for that. Yeah, thank God for that. The topic that I want to talk about today, all of us deal with, and we deal with it all the time, and if we learn to deal with it well, we will flourish. And if we don't learn to deal with it well, we will not flourish. Not dealing with this topic would be sad for anybody, but it would be tragic for Christians, because I'm talking about forgiveness today, and forgiveness is our home court. Okay, forgiveness is our specialty. Forgiveness is our main dish. At least it should be. It should be. So today, teaching on forgiveness and specifically how forgiveness relates to the flourishing life. 4 big questions to tap through this morning. The first is this: why are we including a sermon on forgiveness as part of a bigger series on the flourishing life? 2 reasons for that. There's a big picture reason and there's a very personal reason. The big picture reason that forgiveness is connected to the Christian understanding of a flourishing life is because our ultimate mission is restoration. Jesus came to restore all things. And as followers of Jesus, we're called to walk as Jesus walked, to engage in the mission that Jesus outlined and modeled for us, which means we should be working for restoration as well. It seems like a few generations earlier than me or before me, people were just in general more willing and oriented towards the work of restoration. And I mean this in a really practical way. Like if something broke, you fixed it. You know, 2 or 3 generations ago. If something wore out, you restored it. You would get your shoes resoled. You know, my grandparents would sew their socks back together. Increasingly today, things are designed to be disposable. They're planned to be obsolete. So if something breaks, you don't restore it, you toss it. And you just start over. I think I have 7 old iPhones in a Ziploc bag in my closet. I have no idea what to do with those things. All right, they just don't work anymore. I don't want to throw them away. So it seems to me it's easier in our culture when things aren't working well, specifically relationships, we just walk away from them. We just move on from them. But the Christian is actually called to restore. The biblical view of the flourishing life is not a vision of a brand new world. The Christian vision for a flourishing life is the vision of a renewed world. Not brand new, but renewed world. The song that Amy just sung, what is this light we see? Nations on their knees, kingdoms turning over their thrones to you. This is a vision that we get in Revelation about all of creation bowing before. This is a renewed world. That's the vision. And in the context of relationships, restoration happens through forgiveness. So we might say that forgiveness is an important part of our big picture or our public purpose. And then forgiveness matters because restoration is the goal. Forgiveness is that first critical step towards restoration, reconciliation, then maybe restoration. And then the second reason, this is the personal reason why forgiveness is connected to a Christian view of the good life, is that the willingness and the ability to forgive, and it really is something that we learn how to do. It's a major factor in our personal sense of well-being or our personal level of peace, the ability to forgive. We've used as some of the groundwork for this teaching series the work of a project out of Harvard called the Human Flourishing Project. And what I appreciated about it initially was it just sort of divided life, which is a huge topic, into some more sort of graspable chunks. And the project identifies as one of the chunks of life, kind of this psychological side, areas of psychological distress. Or sometimes it labeled it central negative emotions. And the three that apparently make the biggest impact on our well-being are sadness, fear, and anger. The project roots anger unequivocally in unforgiveness. And the intervention that the project prescribes for anger is forgiveness. And this solution for anger, I almost said the problem of anger, it can be a problem, but the solution for the negative emotion of anger, it's both very specific and it's specifically Christian. And I was surprised by both of these things. I appreciate it. I find it helpful. So the Human Flourishing Project out of Harvard cites 3 major evidence-based studies and concludes this. Research has indicated that forgiving others for wrongs they have done to you is generally associated with better mental health, greater hope, and possibly better physical health. And then it goes on to say, results seem to indicate that forgiveness itself can powerfully promote human flourishing and free the victim from, get this, recurrent cycles of anger and rumination. Rumination is where you just think about it. Free the victim from recurrent cycles of anger and rumination. So to sum up this first point, why are we talking about forgiveness in association with the flourishing life? 2 big reasons. Public picture, forgiveness is part of restoration, and the good life, according to the Bible, is about restoration. And then the personal reason, on a personal level, forgiveness is a way to freedom, especially freedom from anger. I appreciate the evidence-based research that's coming out of Harvard in regard to this project, but really it's just confirming with different and frankly kind of fancy language what Jesus has already taught, right? Which is our second question. What does Jesus teach about forgiveness? A whole lot, a ton, right? His whole ministry, essentially, we could say, is about forgiveness. If we were to paint the picture just with really broad strokes, we might summarize Jesus' teachings on forgiveness with these 3 statements. 1, forgiveness is critical. It's critical. It's crucial. Think about the cross. This is Christ's ultimate work. We symbolize the whole message in the life of Jesus with this symbol because it's that essential. It's that critical. In other words, it's really hard. Jesus teaches we need to both receive forgiveness, that's critical, and offer forgiveness. It's both. And it may be hard to really know and experience forgiveness unless you're actually engaged in forgiveness both directions. You're receiving forgiveness and you're giving forgiveness. There's an integrity that is required in receiving forgiveness genuinely that just says, I must then therefore offer forgiveness as well. So what does Jesus teach about forgiveness? Number one, it's critical. It's not optional. It's essential. It's crucial. Receiving and giving forgiveness. Second thing Jesus teaches, I'm talking just huge, big, broad strokes. Forgiveness characterizes our response to conflict. In other words, what is the Jesus way to respond to conflict? Well, it's characterized by forgiveness. So the Jesus response to problems like we're not getting along, or she insulted me, or even they're nailing nails in my wrists is characterized by this: Father, forgive them. It's characterized by forgiveness. It's not the whole solution. Forgiveness is not the whole solution, but the solution is characterized by this distinctly or Christ-like response, which is, I forgive you. So what does Jesus teach about forgiveness? If we're talking big picture, he teaches forgiveness is critical, it's not optional, and secondly, it characterizes our response. It should characterize our response to conflict. And then third, forgiveness is central to our freedom. I think this is fascinating. Jesus, several times, heals people physically. He frees people from physical illness by saying, your sins are forgiven. Here's an example, John 8, verse 31. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you're really my disciples. And then you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And they answered him, we're Abraham's descendants. We have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free? And Jesus replied, very truly, I tell you, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. And so here's the punchline. So if the son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. If the son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. Jesus connects. This is the big picture I want you to see. Jesus connects freedom with forgiveness. He connects forgiveness with freedom. All right, so much more we could say about Jesus' teachings on forgiveness. Note this, forgiveness is not condoning. Okay, I forgive you does not mean it's okay. It's not condoning behavior. Forgiveness is not rejecting justice. I forgive you does not mean justice doesn't matter, right and wrong doesn't matter. You're not letting go of the principle of justice by forgiving somebody. And forgiveness is not reconciliation. It's a first step towards reconciliation, but I forgive you does not mean everything's fine, we'll just pretend it didn't happen, we'll be back to the way it was before you did that to me. Forgiveness is not reconciliation. There can be no reconciliation without forgiveness because forgiveness is critical, but reconciliation is that long process. Restoration is that long process that often follows or can follow in a relationship when forgiveness happens. So much more we could say. That's like 40,000-foot view of forgiveness, right? I hope that's helpful. Here's a third question. Here's the main question I'd like to address, which is how does forgiveness work? What is effective forgiveness? How do we engage in effective forgiveness? Now, I didn't learn this until I was in my late 20s, like almost 30. Carmen and I lost our first son. In our grief, we felt like we were drowning. We learned we'd never grieved together before. This was our first time to grieve together. We learned we grieved very differently. And in our grief, we hurt each other. And so we sought marriage counseling, and in counseling, we focused a lot on forgiveness. And I've gone back to what we learned in those counseling sessions over and over and over again over the last 20 years. And I call this the forgiveness circle because in my journal from 2002, I wrote these notes in a circle. It's easy for me to slip into a really shallow and ineffective version of forgiving somebody or being forgiven. And it's actually ultimately frustrating when forgiveness sounds like, hey, that hurt. And the other person says, oh, my bad, sorry. And the other person says, it's all right. It doesn't help. It doesn't get to it. It might work for minor offenses, like I leave my socks on the floor all the time. Whatever. But it doesn't help for major offenses. It doesn't help for stuff that actually matters. It drives me crazy. So let me walk you quickly through this forgiveness circle, and I hope it's helpful for you as it has been for me. Of course, it begins with an offense, right? Boom, something happens. Somebody hurts somebody else. And I'm going to use strong language here for the sake of clarity. I'm going to refer to the two people in the relationship as the offender, the one who causes the hurt, and as the victim, the one who is hurt. And I'm going to walk through six steps, two for the victim and four for the offender. First, the victim needs to express, after the offense happens, the victim, the one hurt, needs to express the full extent of the harm done. It's not helpful to manipulate somebody after you've been offended, and neither is it helpful to minimize after you've been offended. Some people manipulate. That means like they'll do the silent treatment, or they'll lord the offense over the offender for years, and they'll never let them out from underneath the guilt there. Some people minimize. I typically minimize. I'll say like, oh, it doesn't matter. It's okay. I don't care. If you're offended, you care. Okay, if you're offended, it hurt. So if somebody actually offends you, it is a big deal. The healthy thing is to express the full extent of the harm done, to be honest and honor the relationship enough to tell the whole truth. So the first step in the process is for the victim, the one who has been offended, to be honest enough to express the full extent of the harm done. And then the offender, now the camera shifts to the offender. What is this person going to do? This is the person who's sinned or has caused the pain. The offender should do four things. They should express understanding first. And you do this by saying, so what I hear you saying is this. And I understand you to be telling me that it hurt you in these ways. And then secondly, the offender should feel sorry. You'll never fully understand, but the hope is that you can empathize enough with the person who's been hurt that you can actually imagine their pain and feel a little bit of it, that you can actually feel sorrow for hurting them. The third step is then to express that sorrow. This is where you say, I'm sorry, but you mean it. You say, I'm sorry, but you mean it. And you're able to mean it because you've paused long enough to understand and you've paused long enough to feel sorry. Have you ever noticed the connection between sorrow and sorry? Somehow I miss that. When people say I'm sorry and they're not sorrowful and they don't understand, it's just more offensive. It just feels like disrespectful. And then fourth, here's where you ask for forgiveness. You say, and this is what you should say, will you forgive me? And that phrase might feel too formal or a little bit spiritual or unusual. I remember when we started using this phrase, it felt a little bit awkward to actually say to one another, will you forgive me? But you should say that. That's a way of applying your Christian faith to real life conflicts with the people that you know and love. Will you forgive me? What you're saying in asking that question is, would you release me from my debt? I've hurt you. I can't unhurt you, but would you extend grace to me for hurting you? I'm sorry that I hurt you. Would you forgive me? And then once the offender asks for forgiveness, man, that's all they can do. That's all they can do in this conversation. Later, there's restitution, right? You crash the car, you You replace the car or whatever. There's restitution, there's reconciliation, there's restoration that needs, there's healing that happens later. But the forgiveness conversation, once the offender asks for forgiveness, that's all the offender can do. Grace is either going to work for that relationship or it's not. Grace is either going to work for that relationship or it's not. By the way, did you catch the part in the cycle where the offender justifies their actions and gives all the excuses for why they did what they did? You didn't, right? Because it's not a part of the conversation for forgiveness. It's a part of another conversation, maybe, for understanding. Can you help me understand a couple weeks later why you always hurt me in this way? Why this thing triggers you the way it does. That's a justified, it's a totally valid conversation, but it's not part of the forgiveness conversation. And the forgiveness conversation gets muddied and ineffective if we sprinkle and spice it in with a bunch of, you need to understand why, and here's my excuses for. Now the responsibility finally shifts back to the victim who can offer forgiveness. And I hope that you will say, I forgive you. I grew up, and this isn't a criticism, it's just the way we spoke in our house, it's okay. That's typically what we said, it's okay. I hope you'll like up it a little bit. I hope you'll go ahead and practice your faith and say, I forgive you. I forgive you. And usually that's a choice and not a feeling, right? And there's a lot of reasons you might make that choice. You might make that choice for God's sake. You might make that choice for their sake, the other person's sake, the offender's sake. And you might make that choice for your own sake. I one time lent somebody a lot of money. It was a lot of money for me. It was like a month's salary. And they didn't pay me back. And they didn't pay me back. And they didn't pay me back. And then I'd see them and they wouldn't bring it up. And then I'd see them again, and they'd buy something else. And I was just getting obsessed with it. I was thinking about it all the time. Whenever I saw them, whenever I saw one of their friends, whenever I saw somebody they related, I was just thinking about it all the time. I was becoming just completely owned by this thing, and I had to recategorize it from, I had to forgive the loan and just say, it's a gift. Because I wasn't going to get the money back. So I just had to say, for my sake, I forgive the loan. You see what I mean? For my sake, I'm going to like, forgive that. Put it in the gift category, and so I can move on. Good. So that's a six-step process toward effective forgiveness. And by the way, the reason it's only half a circle is because what comes next is the long work of rebuilding trust. And it's important, I think, to visually depict that once the person says, you're forgiven, we're not like, bink, right up where we started. There is often a process where we need to rebuild trust, maybe rebuild respect, and it's important to depict that, I think, visually. That's going to take some time, and that's probably going to take some effort. The forgiveness circle is helpful for me. Here's one more reason it's helpful for me is I tend to skip steps, and this reminds me about the important steps in the process. And I'm not trying to make something relatively simple too complicated, but I do want to give you a couple examples. I often skip through the express understanding step. I don't do that. I just rush to I'm sorry. And it sounds empty because I didn't slow down long enough to really understand and then express that understanding. So sometimes when I say I'm sorry, it doesn't work. And I realize it's because I didn't express understanding. And I often will skip the last step too. I find it pretty easy to say I'm sorry, which is the third step in the offender side, the blue side. I find it I apologize a lot. I say I'm sorry probably every week to somebody. But I often will skip the last step, which is to ask for forgiveness. And here's the real reason why. Because when I say, Ben, I'm sorry, I'm still kind of in control. I really am. I still kind of am. Hey, I'm sorry. I'm going to own it. I'm going to be the mature guy, whatever. To say, would you forgive me? I just handed you the power. That's vulnerable, right? That's acknowledging I'm in your debt. Shouldn't have done that, said that, whatever. Ben and I are fine. We're good, right? All right, good. No, it just happened to, yeah. So it helps me to not skip steps to see this kind of rolled out like that. Now, this is an effort to articulate an ideal forgiveness process, and I realize life's rarely ideal. Some of you have been, sometimes people are hurt by you, and they don't tell you for like years. And then they come later, and they're like, yeah, that thing you did 5 years ago that really made me angry. And you're just like, oh, no, I had no idea. That's not ideal, but it happens a lot. Sometimes some of you have been profoundly hurt by another, and they never said, I'm sorry, and they never seeked to understand your pain, and they never asked for forgiveness, and now they're gone. And that's not ideal. And you're left to wrestle with the fallout there. We can only do what we can do when it comes to this. We can only do what we can do. If you've been hurt, you can only do the victim parts, which is to say, you hurt me and I forgive you. Everything else is out of your control. You can only do what you can do. And if you've hurt somebody, if you're the offender, you can only do the offender parts of the circle. You can express understanding. You can feel sorrow. You can say, I'm sorry, and you can ask for forgiveness, and that's all you can do. But it is so important that we do what we can do. It's so important. Last question. When it comes to relational conflict, what is it that Jesus wants from us? What is it that Jesus longs for from us? Well, it's peace over division, I think. The good life, or the ideal, according to Jesus, when it comes to relational conflict, is peace over division. We live in a culture where a lot of people are benefiting from division, and so it's actually to their advantage to keep us divided and to like stir up division, to divide. And it's such a strong current in our culture that we can actually begin to see the good life in the view of division, or with division in view, and by separating. We think, oh, my life will be better if I just separate from them. Or my life will be better if I get rid of the people that don't agree with me on these things. It will just be better. We've thought, some of us have leaned significantly in that direction, because we really have embraced a view of the good life that is characterized by division. God's heart is for peace. God's heart is for reconciliation. God's heart is for the restoration of relationships. Jesus says this in Matthew 5, blessed are the peacemakers. And then his reason is powerful. They will be called children of God. The peacemakers will be called children of God. For Jesus, the good life, or the blessed life, or the flourishing life, it's about peace over division. And last thing I'll say here, this is John 17. This is what's sometimes referred to as Jesus' high priestly prayer. It's a long section in John's gospel. And at one point, Jesus is praying for his disciples. And he says this, I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message. So now he's praying for us and others. Did you know that Jesus prayed for us? He prayed for all who would believe in Jesus through his apostles, his disciples. That includes us. And here's what Jesus prays for us, that all of them may be one. Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. What does Jesus want for us? That we would be at peace with one another, that we would be a force for peace, that we would be peacemakers, not a force for division, that we would be peacemakers in this world, and that when people needed to see an example of the kind of impact the church might have on the world, they'd be able to look in the church and go, yeah, these guys used to disagree. These guys got in a fight one time. These guys got mad because their kids got in a fight, but they figured it out. Grace worked for them. They demonstrated that they value peace over division, peace over division. And they have learned to live a life that's characterized by this remarkable concept. which is not eye for eye, it's forgiveness. Right? Yeah. Let's pray together. Father, I'm just deeply aware, super aware, touched on some pain, and I pray for grace and courage and peace and love to be known by those who have been hurt. And I pray for the ability to navigate complicated situations, situations cannot be adequately addressed in 25 minutes. And I pray that we would trust you at the end of the day, that your way is better. Your way is good. It's truly good. It's good for you. It's good for the world. It's good for us. May we follow you. May we walk as you walked. May we do what you did. May we love as you loved. Please give us grace to be people of forgiveness. In Jesus' name, amen.